I'd like to say welcome to students and other members of the McGill community who are here today. This is the body of the students in this classroom are from Canadian Studies 200, which is an introduction to the study of Canada. And today we're thrilled that we have a guest speaker who is also not only speaking to the class, but performing a double function for the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada in our World Needs More Canada series. We've had Joe Clark and Robert Rabinovich speak to us in the past. This is a fairly new series that we've developed, and we're delighted that the Honorable Ken Dryden has accepted our invitation to speak today on the theme of It's Time for Canada. The other thing about Ken Dryden you should know is that he has very deep roots in Montreal. He's someone who for years was part of the city's most storied and beloved institution, McGill University, of course. For those of you who don't know, Mr. Dryden earned a law degree here in 1974, and we'll never let him forget it. During that time, I guess to keep himself occupied and out of trouble outside of the classroom, Ken Dryden also played a little hockey in a place called the Montreal Forum, not far from here, but with a team that still exists called the Montreal Canadiens. Just a little anecdote, he was drafted by the Boston Bruins in 1964, so we really lucked out because he could well have ended up with one of our main rivals, you know, that place that America calls their own McGill, Harvard University. But Montreal and McGill it was, and after making sure he had a Stanley Cup ring for every finger on his left hand, Mr. Dryden moved on to other things. He wrote The Game, widely hailed as the best hockey book ever written, and was president of the Toronto Maple Leafs, but since you're a McGill grad, we're not going to hold it against you, okay? That's great. Beyond mastering our national sport, and Mr. Dryden, just so you know, the students in the class, we've decided that the three things that define Canada are hockey, Hortons, which you'll be able to partake in after the speech, because we have refreshments, and healthcare, but you don't have to get into that if you don't want to. But apart from playing our national sport, Mr. Dryden has always shown a deep commitment to this country, and he's dedicated much of his professional career to making Canada a better place. He entered politics in 2004 as a member of Parliament for the Toronto Riding of York Centre. He has been re-elected twice since then, and also ran for the Liberal leadership in 2006. He served in Prime Minister Martin's cabinet as Minister of Social Development, where he spearheaded efforts to launch a national childcare program in Canada. He was, even though his party was no longer in power, he was able to negotiate 10 separate agreements with Canada's provinces, and it's a testament to his abilities as a consensus builder, a diplomat, and a tireless champion of Canada's most vulnerable. As his lifetime of achievement and contribution suggest, few individuals are better placed to talk about our country and its place in the world and why it's time for Canada. It's therefore a privilege and a pleasure to introduce one of our most distinguished alumni, one of our most loved citizens, honorary citizens of Montreal, the very Honorable Ken Dryden.
Thank you. Is this working now? I think it is. Okay. Thank you, Antonia. And thanks for the invitation to be here. We actually have a fair amount of ground to cover today, and I know Antonia talked about the class and its usual ending, and for those who are able to stay on afterwards as the discussion continues, that would be great. And so given all that, I won't go into the usual, that I'm really glad to be here and that it's always a treat to be in Montreal and always a treat to be back at McGill. In fact, I've probably spent more time on the McGill campus since graduating than I ever spent as a law student and playing with the Canadians. That was a bit tricky. But as I said, I won't go into this in any detail. I'd like to get to the subject at hand and hope this turns into a real discussion. This is something that I have been thinking about for a long time, but more since I was first elected about 5 years ago. Lots of things can bother us. We can all come to sound like Rex Murphy or Rick Mercer. But what bothers me the most is our wrong sense of ourselves as a country. We are more, so much more than we're willing to see and accept. And this wrong understanding forces us to live under a ceiling that is so far below what we can do and can be. So far below that anything we as individuals or governments can imagine ourselves doing, economically, socially, environmentally, internationally, becomes too modest and certain to remain that way until we can think about ourselves differently. As a country, what should we do in the bigger world? About climate change, about world hunger. At home, what should we do about poverty within our borders? Well, it depends on whether we see ourselves wrongly as relatively small and powerless, economically, culturally, and militarily, a backwater far from where the action is, or as the candidate we really are, today, now, and in the future. Because if you have the wrong story, you get the wrong answer. I've seen it all my life, seen it as a child, seen it as a parent, as a player in Montreal, we're on a team with the right tradition, the right story, when winning was the singular understanding, we won. And in Toronto, as team president, when winning mattered a lot and making money mattered a little more, we almost won. I've seen it as Ontario Youth Commissioner with school dropouts, and in writing a book on education when I went back to high school for a year to see who among the students around me was learning and who wasn't, who had the right understanding of themselves as learners and who didn't. Again, wrong story, wrong answer. And now I see it in politics. It's not the political games that hold us back, not most of all. It's us. As politicians, it's our job to understand the country, what it is, what it can be, our ambitions. Then it's our job to use that art of the possible to deliver on those ambitions. But it's not politics that defines the possible. We do, all of us. And as politicians, as citizens, what we see in Canada now, in 2009, is much less than we really are, much less than where our ambitions, our hopes can take us. This is what I want to talk to you about today. Because if we don't get our story of Canada right, I can't do what politicians need to do, and you can't live the life that's in you to live. It's time. We are more than this. We are better than this. That's why I'm talking to students at universities across the country. Last spring at Mount Allison, Trent, Acadia, St. Mary's, Dalhousie, St. Evex, Manitoba, Regina, and Ottawa U, until exams brought things to a close. And now it's time to begin again. But how do we write this story that is us? I don't know entirely. That's also why I'm here. I need to hear your thoughts and ideas. So today, in the first part of our time together, I'll tell you what I think, because in the second part, I need to hear what you think. Let's start. This is not about politics. This is personal. This is about Canada. I was born in 1947. I grew up in a suburb of Toronto to middle-class parents who hadn't gone to university and had never even dreamed they would. By the time I was six, I lived in a new house surrounded by lots of other new houses with a new school, new church, new playground and hockey rink less than a block away. I grew up in a Canada that was surrounded by a world of destruction and deprivation. The relentless poverty of Asia,
the humanity-choked hopelessness of China and India, the impossibility of Africa, the corrupt sadness of Central and South America, and a Europe so fundamentally flawed that it had twice tried to annihilate itself in 30 years. I grew up in a Canada that was neighbor to the greatest power on earth, the United States of America, the greatest place on earth, New York, Hollywood, cars, stars, where everything was bigger and more exciting. And the U.S. was a good place, a decent place of freedom and prosperity, where everyone had a chance, where even the poor would do well someday. I grew up in a house where on our kitchen wall we had a map of the world. And every morning at breakfast with the newspaper, for every world event and game I'd read about, I'd look at that map and attach the event to it and feel I was almost there myself. And on that map, just like on all the maps in all our classrooms at school, the pink outline of Canada was so big, so much bigger than the pink of Britain and purple of France, almost as big as the purple of the Soviet Union, and far bigger than the yellow of the US and China. We were big. Canada was big. And I knew and we knew that if you had space, population would come. Importance would come. The future would come. If you had space, you had resources. And even if a lot of that space was cold and remote, someday it wouldn't be. Frontiers were made to be tamed and made into something special. Space was destiny. It was only a matter of time, and our time would come. I had no doubt. We had no doubt. To me, to us, emerging out of World War II, the U.S. was a country of greatness realized on the way to something greater. Canada was a country of greatness imagined and greatness imaginable. But by the 1960s, things began to feel different. Neither the U.S. nor Canada was living up to this special promise. For the U.S., it was the problems of race, the Vietnam War, the Cold War, the materialism of a consumer society, the conformism of the suburbs, the corporate and governmental abuses of power which brought about the rise of Ralph Nader and Watergate. For Canada, the disappointment we felt had to do with being so irresistibly tied to the U.S., with the southward drain of our stars, not just in business, science, entertainment, and the arts, but in every field, with government and corporate decisions, it seemed, always being made in Washington, New York, or Dubuque. So humiliating. With all our special promise, I wondered, we wondered, is this what Canada was really about? When their country stumbled, American myth-makers turned angry. Ours, our journalists and media stars, turned cynical. No matter what we do, it seems, anything, everything, we just can't quite pull it off. Typically Canadian, eh? When CBC radio icon Peter Zosky ran a contest on his show for a phrase that best described our national identity, the winner, as Canadian as possible under the circumstances. Funny, wise sounding. Today in Canada, we're still under the thumb of these old myths and myth-makers and their understanding of Canada. Even if the world and Canada have changed dramatically, even if we as Canadians are ready to see ourselves very differently. In recent decades, this story of Canada and the story of the U.S. didn't change very much, year after year, until Obama. During last year's election campaign, Mr. Obama, in essence, said to the American people, "Stop, everyone. Look around. Is this America? The America we all grew up in? That special, special place of forever new frontiers, geographical, intellectual, of the imagination? That special place of optimism, possibility, of forever becoming? Is this the real America we see? Iraq, torture, healthcare that has no place for tens of millions of fellow citizens, the exaggerated wealth and exaggerated poverty and the exaggerated gap between them. Is this what this country stands for? Is this the American dream? Is the real purpose of all this freedom and liberty just more and more and more? More and bigger cars, more food, more things, more than we can really use, more than we even care about, more than is good for us as people, as a society, as a planet. This obesity of body and mind and spirit that has crept into our lives and that seems unstoppable, is this us? No, Mr. Obama was saying. We are better than this. So what is the new American dream? What is worthy of America? That is what Mr. Obama is asking. And last November on Election Day, Americans responded. Americans want to believe in themselves. They want to believe in Obama because they want to believe in America again. I think Canadians want the same for Canada. Look at us. We are 33 million people, one of the world's largest economies, one of the world's richest nations. We have a huge and abundant landmass amidst a world of congested countries. We are safe, secure, and stable. Because of our Aboriginal history, their countless nations and their challenge to survive, because of our French and English past of different languages, cultures, religions, and laws, because we have people inside our borders today from almost everywhere, we are a country that is learning to live with difference, accept difference, learn from difference, when in the rest of the world, difference often, instinctively, still means guns and blood. Look at us. All those good words from others that sometimes make us squirm. A country that's clean, civil, modest, polite, tolerant and respectful. A place with wide open spaces that's livable. A great place to raise kids. A place that's nice. A country that's dull and boring, cynics say. Compared to whom? The U.S.? Boring meaning no big surprises, no rampant disease, terrorist attacks, hurricanes, earthquakes, major economic or political disasters. A country without tabloid extremes? Tabloid boring? Instead, a country where you can plan for tomorrow, count on tomorrow, when billions around the world cannot. All those things about us that embarrass us a little, all those things the world is dying for. Countries come and go, prominent for a time, then pushed to the sidelines in another. History is a long time. Whatever Canada has been in the past, we will be far more in the future. The world knows it. We need to know it too. What is worthy of us? What is worthy of Canada? To think about Canada, we need to think about the world too. Once the world was a disconnected place, disconnected by distance, by geography, oceans, mountains, deserts, by culture, by custom, by language, by laws, by borders, even by thought. Each, all, reinforcing difference, exaggerating difference. Now the world is connected, and a connected world cannot be about difference. A connected world has to be about, can only be about, getting along, living together, and the instincts and instruments for doing that. It's not enough for us to think globally and act locally. We must think globally and act globally in order to act locally too. What is worthy of the world? And where do we fit in? What do you think? I'm here because as students, you're old enough to know enough of the present to imagine the future, yet young enough not to be overburdened by the past. I'm here because you are our best imaginers, because you haven't yet learned to overwhelm what you feel with explanation, because you're still able to be outraged by the outrageous and excited by the exciting. I'm here because the big, tough, necessary global fights of the future, human rights, poverty, starvation, climate change, demand outrage and excitement. I'm here because even though I know some of you are not interested in politics, I know all of you are interested in the world. Today, that world order is shifting. The rise of China and India, the return of Russia, the worldwide threat of climate change, the U.S. and European economic meltdown. The U.S. is still the world's preeminent power, but now this is a true global world. It's time, the time, to reimagine the world, to reimagine Canada. What is it about Canada that matters? So that if Canada didn't exist, the world wouldn't be as good a place. What matters now? And what will matter to the world? That's the question. Is it Canada as a northern country with the great impact, economic, environmental, cultural, and military, the North will have on the world's future and the chance for us to do it better this time? Maybe. Is it Canada as an environmental model? Our forests, lakes, and rivers, mountains, and prairies are what others think of first when they think of us. The environment is beauty. The environment is riches. The environment is both together in a sustainable way. Perhaps. Is it Canada as innovator? The world isn't about knowing, it's about learning. The sun revolves around the earth until we learn it doesn't. What we know is just a placeholder for what we will learn someday. Our population, more broadly educated per capita than anywhere else in the world, our immigrants from everywhere bringing their centuries of learning with them, together generating great innovation? Possibly. What do you think? For me, I think there's a bigger role, a more important role worthy of Canada, worthy of the world. In a global world, as you know, we can no longer avoid each other. All those different languages, different cultures, customs, traditions and understandings, all those different experiences, backgrounds and personal histories, all those deep in the bone stereotypes and prejudices, conflicts and misunderstandings, all the water of centuries and centuries gone under the bridge, suddenly, now, they are all in one place, here. The biggest challenge of a global world, I think, is not economic
or environmental or military. It is living together. Our country was not created out of revolution. We have no history of civil war. On matters that might have led to the breakup of our country, we held two referendums. For more than 15 years, we've had in our federal parliament a major party whose purpose is an independent Quebec. Our instinct is not to fight. It is to work things out. Immigrants new to the country who carry with them histories of bloody hostility, often against those who are now their next-door neighbors, are given a quiet, subtle message when they arrive. It may be the only real obligation of Canadian citizenship. Its message, we get along here. It's not a message for an age of empire. Then the world was about power and might. The strong didn't have to get along. The weak did. The strong could believe they were right and act as if they were right because they could impose right. In Canada, we lived in a huge space, in small, subtle groups in which no group was big enough to pretend to dominate another. The losers of history, some have called them. French Canadians, loyalists, displaced Highland Scots, Irish fleeing the potato famine. We needed each other to survive. We had to get along, so we did. In an age of empire, this made us seem weak and irrelevant. But in a post-empire age, power and might are not enough. The strong can't impose right so easily. The weak are numerous and not so weak to be imposed upon. We all have to find accommodation. We all have to get along. As Canadians, we know how. Many do not. In an age of globalism, this makes us remarkable and crucial. In an age of empire, homogeneity was good. In an age of globalism, it is not. Recently, I was at our daughter's graduation. It was held outside. One of the speakers talked about the beautiful canopy of trees above us, how a century ago they were all elms, tall, majestic, perfect. Then disease came and wiped out most of them. The few that survived made it, in part, because other species of trees were planted in their midst. The genetic diversity of nature had brought adaptability, resilience. Diversity, it turned out, was good, healthy, necessary. The monoculture of elms could not survive. The multiculture of elms, oaks, maples and honey locusts survive and thrive. Who knew? It's all a great surprise. As a country, we didn't get here through any plan. We lived our life circumstances, adapted with each turn in the road, and this is what we became. Now we find ourselves in this very strange position where the line on the world graph and the line on the Canada graph have come together. We are going where the world is going. We are what the world needs. We get along here. All those things that embarrass us a little, being civil, modest, polite, tolerant and respectful, getting along, having a history without the glory of revolution or civil war, all the things the world is dying for, all things a global world needs, all things the future needs. That's us. We're a living experiment. If a global world can't work in Canada, it won't work anywhere. We matter a lot. And we'll matter more and more and more in the future.
We need to know that. We need to understand that about ourselves. Not to become complacent, but the opposite. To become ambitious. To take on the big questions of the future with the right understanding of ourselves. What should the most global country in a global world do about human rights, poverty, starvation, climate change? The short answer? More. Much more. It's time. What do we do about all this? How do we become fully what we are? We need a common story. And because the US, Britain, France, and others have found their common story in their history, it seems that we must as well. As if there's a formula, and a common story can only emerge out of history, that we have skipped a step and need to go back before we can go ahead. And we've tried that with the big CBC series, Canada, A People's History, with Heritage Minutes, with new histories like John Ralston Saul's A Fair Country, which came out last year. But none of them have even begun to shake our old understandings of ourselves. Too many people and too many groups have too much of a stake in their past. French, English, East, West, if we try to win old fights, they just become new fights. Forever fights. This isn't about defeating old stories. It's about writing new ones. New stories that make the old ones seem less important. Our past can deepen and enrich our sense of ourselves, no doubt about it. But we need to find our common story. We need to search for our future in what we are now. And that's good. Very good. Being tolerant isn't easy. Accepting people greatly different from ourselves isn't easy. And maybe our biggest achievement has been resisting the almost impossible pull to be just like the U.S. The U.S. is a spectacularly successful country. We share the same landmass. Who wouldn't want to be just like the U.S.? What except a perverse, knee-jerk anti-Americanism would keep us from imitating their every move? But our history is a little different. Our land and climate are harsher. Our success, not so certain. We learned in the past that we needed our neighbor and our neighbor needed us. It made us maybe a little more forgiving, a little more generous, and a little more humble. The individual and individual rights mattered, but collective rights did too. We learned that some things had to be done together, that sometimes government needed to play a role. We've had to accept higher taxes to deliver to remote and disadvantaged places what we believe every Canadian should have. We knew we weren't going to be the richest, so our pursuit of wealth is tempered by other things that also make life feel good. All this, not to the extent that quite feels right to us. Too often we fall far short. But the gap between our rich and poor, though much wider than in Western Europe, is far less than the U.S. We said no to Vietnam, no to Iraq, and yes to Medicare. We take great pride in having a public health care system. In poll after poll, we describe it as central to our identity. It seems almost embarrassing that we do. Tommy Douglas was named as CBC's greatest Canadian. Surely there must be more to us than a public health care system. But our pride is not just in health care itself. It's that we did it. It matters. And it's right. And that the U.S. couldn't and, till now, can't. It would have been so easy for us not to. There is something so compelling about the American idea of the melting pot. People from everywhere coming together, having a place, making an American life for themselves. Their languages, cultures, traditions gradually melting out of existence. It would have been so easy for us to do the same. But those Canadians who came earlier to Canada were not so numerous, and our established culture was not so defined when others arrived, so we didn't impose. We chose to understand ourselves as what we now call a multicultural society, and to be proud of that. And maybe that's what we were and are. But now we are moving on to something else, to something new in the world, to a rich, remarkable experiment, to a global culture, to a multicultural society. That's us. In the past, it would have been so easy to insist on something else. Now, even if we wanted to go back to a French and English Canada, to a white-skinned existence, we can't. It's too late. We have to make this work. We have no choice. And it's exciting. As historian Mark has said, the writing of history really began in the 1800s. In an age of power and glory and empire, history was the story nations and governments wanted to have written. In tomorrow's world, there won't be one culture, one language, one set of understandings. No one is going to conquer the world. Today, attempting to live up to the glories of that old story will kill us all. We need a new story, a new history, one that accommodates many cultures, many languages, many understandings, that accepts differences, that can live with differences, that highlights getting along. For Canada, the absence of a strong central story, a strong central narrative, has allowed us to be what we are, to become what we have become. What always seemed our problem has become our great good fortune. Canada is where the world is going. Who knew? But whether we knew that's what we were doing or not, this is what we are. And that also forces us to live up to our own selves and set our own bar higher. We have to be tolerant and decent, fair and generous. In a pre-global world, these seemed like soft values, the rhetoric of losers. In a global world, these are the essentials. Because those left out will no longer rest quietly on the sidelines. And without those essentials, the hard values, economic growth and prosperity, will be blown apart. We get along here. It's the way we are. It's the only way a global world can work. But it's a very hard standard to meet. In health, in education, in life circumstances, it means everyone deserves a chance. Everyone. Anything else is not fair, not right, not acceptable. Close the gap between our rich and our poor as good ethics, good economics, and good for what makes life feel right. We need to trust our values, our experiences, what we've learned, what we have become. No hesitation. We have to trust us being us. The world needs more Canada, but Canada needs more Canada too. As a country, we are ready for more. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Like you, I've been in big, new, challenging situations such as this in my own life. I was the kid from nowhere suddenly in the Stanley Cup playoffs. in Boston Garden against the Stanley Cup champions. Like you, I didn't know if I could do it. The good thing, I didn't know I couldn't. I just played. All those backyard ball hockey games, all those moments dreaming and imagining, all those ups and downs, it turned out I was ready. I had no idea. I had become what I needed to be. It was time for me then. It's time for us now. Listen to these names, Canadian names. Guy Laliberté, Frank Gehry, Justin Morneau, Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro, Mike Lazaridis, Céline Dion, Kiefer Sutherland, Leonard Cohen, Gord Downie, Sidney Crosby, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Ben Heppner, Karen Kane, Jason Bay, Wayne Gretzky, Diana Krall, Douglas Copeland, Robert Lepage, Michel Tremblay, Bobby Orr, K.D. Lang, Avril Lavigne, Michael Bublé, Haley Wickenheiser, Rohinton Mystery, Gilles Vigneault, Mario Lemieux, Shania Twain, Michael Ondaatje, Adam Egoyan, Steve Nash, Isidore Sharp, Louise Arbour, David Suzuki, Jim Balsillie, Ann Michaels, Jeffrey Skoll, Christopher Plummer, Sam Roberts, Sarah Pauley. Canadian names. What these names say isn't about their work. It's about what their work says. And that work says, I can. I matter. These are our real storytellers. This is what we really are today. It's time. Steven Pinker, a Harvard linguist and philosopher, and a Canadian, wrote recently about individual life, saying, "None of us knows what made us what we are, and when we have to say something, we make up a good story." It's the same for a country. But that story has to be a good one, because the wrong story leads to the wrong future. And we've had the wrong story for a long time. But now the right one is right here in front of us. History is not just about writing the past. History is about writing the future. How do we get to there from here? We talk about it just as we're doing today, at every university across the country. And if we believe it, we talk to others. We connect to a website and to each other. A website that is intelligent enough, challenging and smart enough to be interesting, to be cool, and rough-edged enough to make people feel their own words and images are good enough to add to it. To make them want to connect, puzzle through, and seek out something together, not just rant. To make them players, not spectators. Over time, the story builds, deepens, broadens, grows richer. A national conversation begins. Others write about it, talk about it. Writers, journalists, musicians, business people, academics, historians, politicians, whomever. The conversation grows, builds. People who felt this way about Canada for years suddenly feel the right to express what they feel. These thoughts, ideas, ambitions enter the language even of the most unusual suspects. Suddenly they're just there, part of our understanding of ourselves, part of our language, finally part of our politics, part of what Canadians come to demand from their political parties, from their party leaders, from their prime minister, a standard to which each must rise and meet. The public expects, insists, the political parties begin to respond, to compete. The story they tell in their speeches and platforms is now of this bigger Canada. This bigger Canada is evoked again and again to explain, to justify each policy announced. This bigger Canada becomes a standard against which we decide the dimensions of our policies. What would this Canada do about climate change, about transforming our economy, about poverty, about our role in the world? Typically Canadian, eh? No. No. In the future, same words, new tone, filled with ambition and pride, filled with an understanding of our important place in the world, our important place in the future. Typically Canadian, eh? It's time. It's time to know we are more than this. It's time for a country where life can be imagined, hoped for, planned for, and dreamed, where life can be counted on. It's time for a country respectful of others, respectful of difference, respectful of the future. It's time for a country that's where the world is going. We get along here. It's time to know what we are and be what we are. No more an echo or shadow. It's time to be loud and proud. It's time for Canada. Thank you. Thank you. I will sit down. And for as much time as anyone has here, I would like to for our conversation to begin, and to hear from you what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you wonder about. It's been fun doing this so far in at the other campuses, and as I said, this is the first one of this fall. But with lots of others ahead. And so the first one is always the hardest. I see a hand there. Yes, sir.
I'm slightly confused at the idea of becoming what we are. Because if we are something, how do we become it further? I wonder what you mean exactly when you say that we are a place where we get along, and we are a place that is the future, yet we need to become that still. Mm-hmm. I'm quite lost as to where we stand. Mm-hmm. Are we not that yet, or will we be that in the future? Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I'm trying to say is that is what we are, but we don't understand ourselves to be that. That we understand ourselves to be much less interesting, much less important, and not to understand that aspect of ourselves as important. That we tend to understand that aspect of ourselves as very unimportant. That others have talked about the qualities that make up the capacity of getting along, and whether it is being civil and patient and all the rest, and there to make those out as qualities of weakness, qualities of backwater. And what I'm suggesting is that those kinds of qualities are precisely what is essential for any multiculture to work, to any global world of the future to work. And so it is really what I'm trying to suggest is that is what we are, but we don't understand the importance of that. And unless we do, we will understand ourselves as a backwater, aspire to a backwater, and never achieve what in fact we could achieve and contribute to ourselves and to the world. Thank you. Yes?
I agree. I'm actually glad of what you were saying, especially in terms of Canadians kind of having this sense of an idea that our history and kind of like how Canada came to be is much less interesting than, you know, the past or, I guess, kind of the makeup of other countries. Like, I'm not exactly sure if it's kind of a factor of being almost constantly bombarded, probably, with, like, foreign media, especially the U.S., because I know even, like, in my childhood, I seem to remember, like, a lot more, you know, like, a lot of, like, TV shows and things coming from the U.S. that kind of, you know, talk about, you know, like, I guess, American history, and, you know, like, this happened, and this is why this is today, and we used to, like, should be proud of this and this, whereas somehow it seems like we've kind of failed to instill in ourselves how, like, I guess some of these, like, how much, like, how far Canada actually came as a nation. Even, I was at a conference last year, and I can't remember exactly the context of this, like, statement was made, but it's something that's really stuck with me. It was somebody, I believe they were an international student. It really doesn't make a difference anyway. But they made the statement, because we were talking about someone asked, well, why are we always talking about the U.S. and we're never talking, you know, about Canada? I believe it was an international relations class. And someone made the comment, well, Canada's hardly changed in the past 100 years anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but I mean, okay. I'm like, but I mean, that, like, kind of made me stare, but it really didn't seem to, like, make a lot of people flinch.
Right.
There's this idea that, like, what's happened here has been so, like, minor compared to so many other places that...
And that's what, I mean, all of what I was talking about today, there are things that I've been thinking about for a long time, but really, in the last 3 or 4 years, even more so since I've been in Ottawa, and of realizing that so many of the things that we say we would like to do and that we have to do in terms of, you know, again, those big questions and climate change or poverty or economic transformation or any of those things, is that when we put together proposals for them, they are proposals that are, you know, a little bit better than what already is, as opposed to what may need to be. And that when that we deal within the margins of this, you know, a little bit better, a little bit worse, but we get, you know, not very far in terms of the real questions and what we should be doing. And it seemed to me that if I was going to continue to do what I'm doing, that it wasn't going to work to just try to dream up a better policy or a better program, because a better policy or a better program within an atmosphere and environment that imagines something only a little bit better or a little bit worse will never have the chance to be anything more than a little bit better or a little bit worse. That what was needed was to help talk about the basic environment in which we live as this country, and at the same time, you know, to me that what we are, that there is something important going on here. And that this isn't just kind of creating an artificial environment so that we can, you know, achieve something by pretending that we're something other than what we are. No, it's to acknowledge what it is we really are, as opposed to going on pretending what we never have been. And that you just can't get anywhere, whether you are in business or in politics or the arts or whatever, if you're operating under this ceiling of the wrong story. And that's the part, you know, that really drives me nuts. And when you're talking about the history, and I mean, one of the things, and there was, I made a reference in there to, you know, the history that we kind of assume that, you know, the Britain, France, and the U.S., that, you know, that they have found their story in their history, so therefore we have to do the same thing, so we do all of these, you know, these history things. I don't think so. I think what we have to do is find in ourselves a common story and a common kind of understanding of what it is we are, but that doesn't mean it has to come out of history. And where it sort of, you know, that I mean, this summer I read John Ralston Saul's book, A Fair Country. I don't know if any of you have read that book here.
And it's an interesting book. I mean, and it talks about how, you know, how we are shaped far more by our Aboriginal history than by our European history and our French and English history. He might be right, I don't know. But what I think is more right is that even if he is right, it won't change our understanding of ourselves in any way that will drive us to be what it is we really are and to contribute to the world as what we really can contribute. And so it's interesting, but interesting isn't enough. What's got the drive? Where's the compelling narrative that people, you know, can understand? I can imagine history as becoming playing a secondary role in the creation of this, you know, of our future understanding of ourselves. But I think that if we depend on going back into history, writing it more interestingly, and assume that everybody's suddenly going to find it interesting and make it their story and propel us into the future, I think it won't happen. That it will only happen out of our sense of ourselves now. And then, you know, then in finding that sense of ourselves now, then it's like, oh wow, you know, that's why it mattered, you know, this part of our history and that part of our history and the rest of it. But I think that if we expect history to be the driving force of our contemporary and our future story, I think we will go again at it and again at it and again at it and again at it, and we will not get anywhere. Yes?
But I think we build our central narrative on our future and the common values that all Canadians share. I guess things that are like common good and common to all Canadians regardless of where they live. And I think that it's those things that are future and those common values that will build the central Canadian narrative rather than looking back at our history. I think it's something that we accept as like the ancestral history, kind of like we're the past of our parents, but it's more the future that we'll build on.
Yeah, I think so. And the thing is that it's a great contemporary story. That's the part, and it is perhaps, and I would argue it is unique. It is a unique story in the world now. That makes for a great story. But again, if we don't see ourselves in that sort of a way, you know, this is where we end up being. I mean, again, we all have our own reference points. Some of mine are sports reference points. But I know you don't go into a season where you have in you a story that can lead to a Stanley Cup at the end, and you don't have as your story, we might do okay. Let's see how we could do in this. You know, let's make the playoffs. Maybe we could finish as high as 10th. You know, if we have in us to win it, then you kill yourself with the wrong story. You just, you know, if you come in, you know, aspiring to 10th, you'll be 10th. Now, if you are only able to be 10th, that's another thing. But in this kind of global world where those things that, you know, that matter the most are not necessarily the big power games of military or economic, where the essential things may be somewhere else, then we are absolutely, totally well situated in order to be an important player. Yes? One of you at the back, then two of you together.
So clearly, the point of the lecture was talking about Canada's need to assert itself on the world stage and become a more prominent country. What would you say the point is that's keeping Canada from doing that? Is it a need for stronger leadership on the national level? Is it a need for more sort of academic writing? Is it a need for a greater participation in the democratic process? What is it that specifically that's holding Canada back, would you say?
Well, I mean, and that's the question in it, or to put it the other way is to, if this is where we are, what is it that we can do that would, you know, that would make things different? I mean, when you look again at what has happened in the U.S. in the last 2 years, the 2 years ago and before Obama, there was very little talk and very little coherent talk about
you know, about is this what we are? Is this? I mean, it would come out in terms of people's feelings about floundering around here and floundering around there, but without the kind of focus that Obama, you know, has brought it. I think what has happened in the U.S. is that it was politics that led the conversation, that led the debate. I mean, it wasn't that people weren't experiencing it, feeling it, you know, intimating it to each other, you know, all of that. But in terms of any kind of focused discussion or debate, it was politics that led and the public that followed. In Canada, it may well be that the public will lead and the politics will follow. I don't know, but what I do know about politics is that if this sort of thing is in the air, if this is part of the national conversation, the political ears will hear it, will pick it up, and will start reflecting it and expressing it, and start competing with each other, you know, on it. And that's of course exactly what you want. You know, is for people to start to compete with each other in terms of anything that you hope will become bigger and more central. So, I mean, I think it is there. I mean, one of the things that has been terrific this summer, I decided that what I wanted to do after giving these talks in the spring is put a wish list together of people that I could think of as sort of the most interesting people, and who are our storytellers in lots of ways, novelists, filmmakers, musicians, for the most part, and sort of make a list of them, call them up, email them, send them an outline of what it is I'm doing, send them a copy of the speech that I was giving last March, and say, I'd like to talk to you more about this if you'd like to talk to me about it. And they've all said yes. And they were all really interesting, you know, their responses, but what was uniformly their response was, yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about and trying to express in various different ways for a long time and so on. So, I mean, I think that's how I can imagine it going ahead, but that's a big part of this question. If politics doesn't lead, how does it happen? I mean, Obama, if he's leading, he can say, when somebody says, well, what can I do? I feel the same way as you do. What can I do? He had an answer. Vote for me. You know, or, you know, send me a contribution tomorrow. If politics doesn't lead, then what is the answer to that question? And I'm not entirely sure what the answer is to that question, except, you know, more of this sort of thing, websites engaging people, and gradually it becomes part of the language, you know, of how we think about ourselves. Other than that, I don't know. And that's what I'd like to hear in part from you. I think you had your head up for a while.
I've heard, like, listening to what you're talking about, there's a really strong undertone of empowering ourselves, empowering others. And so that empowerment theme seems really central to me, and that's really important for anyone who's ever felt, who hasn't felt like they are empowered, who's felt like one thing you said is, I didn't know I could, but I didn't know I couldn't. For those who have begun to feel like they couldn't, it's almost an impossible cycle to get out of. I've had it happen to me, and you kind of set yourself up for your own failure. And so I really think you've struck on that aspect very well. That's a dangerous way place to get into. And now relating that to politics, especially in kind of the democratic context, I think that it takes either an individual or a group of individuals with an extreme amount of bravery to take the chance to empower. Because within the democratic context, innovation is more often than not something that is going to lose you votes as opposed to something that is going to be successful and win you more. It's a risky endeavor to propose, okay, let's completely overhaul, reform healthcare.
looking at Obama as an example, if you read his writings, you get the sense that he's much more, he wants to do much more than he is able to do currently in his role as president. And you get the sense, even a couple of years ago, he was in favor of a Canadian-based single-payer system. But in his capacity as president, he can't do that because it's risky and he has to come up with compromise. But at the same time, he's making some form of change. So it takes, I think, a degree of people deciding that, yes, they can do this if they want to, that it can be a reality, that we can help these people, that we can help each other, ourselves, but at the same time it takes someone and a party and politicians who are willing to take the chance to say, we're going to try this healthcare thing, I'm skeptical, we're going to make it work, and then everyone else doing that as well. So, of course, that's also very hard.
It is hard, but I think that what's harder is living with the alternative. I mean, it's not interesting, the alternative. It's not worthy. It's not and it's not up to what needs are the alternative. And yes, you're absolutely right. About deciding to take on big stuff. But you know, if you were to go back, I guess it was before the summer, in terms of Obama, before the sort of building quagmire, it seems, over healthcare. I mean, when you think of the things that have been taken on in the last, since January of 2009. I mean, stuff that each individually was too much. I mean, of working on transforming the financial system, of becoming a real player in terms of climate change, whereas for the last 8 years, the U.S. has been no player whatsoever in terms of climate change. I mean, and you could go into two or three other areas as well. Each of them individually was far too big to take on by any kind of conventional understanding. But, if it's there to be taken on, then I think the public, to a much greater extent than what politicians believe and what the kind of the political environment would say, is actually ready for their governments and their politicians to take on. I mean, all of us as politicians, I mean, this is what we, that as soon as something comes up, I mean, our instincts are those of a citizen before they are of a politician. And as a citizen, it's like, oh, geez, this is pretty big, and if we fail, I mean, we'll just get hammered and the rest of it. And so then the expression that comes out of our mouths as politicians is well, the public's not ready for it. I mean, they just won't accept it. I mean, all they want is less taxes. That's all they want. That's all they want. Cut the GST by a couple of percentage points. $12 billion gone from possibilities. That's all they want. You just appeal to that, and you'll win the day, and you'll win every room in the country. I don't think that's right. I think there are a lot. I would say the majority of Canadians actually don't feel that way. They want something more. They want to feel something more. They want to be proud. And I think that we shy away from calling that bluff, and first of all, it's calling our own bluff, and then calling a public's bluff, and to see in it. Obama did not become the world's most popular politician by being like any of his predecessors. Now, I don't know who was next in order here. Maybe at the back. Oh, sorry, I wasn't looking over there. Go here and then there.
As mentioned before, Mr. Dryden, a big theme of your speech has been the wrong story, that Canada has the wrong perception of itself and an incorrect, a sort of skewed view of what it is and what it constitutes. I guess my question is, how is it that we got everything so right then?
And what I mean by that is we've built one of the most successful modern democratic societies in the world. Economically, we are powerful. The HDI says we're one of the top five best countries on the planet. Just resource after resource suggests that something about Canada in our 100-year history got it correct. So with that wrong story, which you're suggesting, without that correct story or whatever that may constitute, we cannot continue to develop successfully. How is it for the past 100 years, without a story, without a narrative, we have yet created this amazing political institution of what Canada is today?
I think, and that's a very good question, and I think part of the answer is our resources. I think part of our answer was the impact from pretty successful economies from Europe, first of all, and then living next to the United States. I think all of those things helped immensely. Yeah. But I think that what was, again, always not sort of understood and not front and center and not understood to be an important value all the way along were all of these other aspects to ourselves of where, you know, you are, you know, relatively small, relatively on the margins, you know, not a focal point, you know, for anybody, always where our gaze is somewhere else, and being kind of listeners and discussers and negotiators and compromisers and all of those things, because we are not big guys, but we can live in a big guy's world because we've got some of the resources that the big guys want. So I think that's at least a fair amount of an answer to what, you know, to your question. But I think that what has surprised us out of that, as I mentioned in the latter part of my answer there, and as I mentioned in my speech, was how all of those other qualities that were understood to be weaknesses have actually become strengths as the world has become a different place. And where all of those, you know, the big powers of the past in a global world, nobody's a big power. I mean, you know, even the U.S. as the most powerful nation in the world, I mean, you know, it cannot act as an overwhelmingly powerful country in a global world. I mean, it engages in two relatively small wars and has a really hard time and is really stretched to be engaged in those two wars and in terms of the world economy and the rest of it. So, you know, I think that it is, you know, it is resources, it's proximity, it is our historical contacts that have been very important, you know, for us in becoming what it is we are. But it is in living that existence of being neighbor to the big powers, and how you become that. It has led us to certain attitudes, understandings, skills, approaches, which are absolutely the right things for any kind of global world to make us even more important in the future.
Thank you.
Sorry, the gentleman behind.
Yep. Thank you. Do you really think that our political system will let us accomplish this with the way it is right now, with the regional fighting, the political infighting, the now negative politics, which is seeming to become more and more the norm these days? Do you think that, like, the systems we have the ability to achieve what you're proposing?
I think that in fact what it is we have now will not change at all unless we take on an approach like this. So long as we have the two main parties, neither of them in disarray, so that each relatively strong, but neither of them having much, affection in Quebec, So long, then, as we have four parties of some strength, I think that we're talking about minority governments not just in an election 6 weeks from now or 6 months from now, but 6 years from now. I mean, there's nothing to break that, and I think the only thing that breaks it is either on the downside, where one of the major parties kind of fragments, as the conservatives did through the 90s, or in fact one of the major parties becomes much more forward and ambitious in this kind of way. I mean, otherwise, and I think in the end, if the focus of working together is political and of getting parties to work together, then parties have no incentive to sort of work together as parties. I mean, it's the ideas in behind those parties that in fact may find some common ground. And if you had a more compelling national understanding, then I think that you'd find the parties, more similar and with more pressure to kind of work, with some accommodation one to the other, as opposed to the way it is now. Is that what is it that would connect those parties in order to find a way for the for a minority government to really work? I mean, what is there except politics? And politics doesn't do it. I mean, politics just breaks apart, and I mean, it never really comes together and breaks apart really quickly at first opportunity. So I think that we're probably facing what it is we have now unless we move in this sort of direction. There's somebody over here. Yes?
Can you tell us what Neil Young said when he wrote that?
Oh, I haven't. Neil Young isn't one of them. I hope Neil Young will be one of them at some point. So, yeah?
It seemed that the sort of spirit of getting along is something that you think is really important here in Canada. Do you think that if you start to try to be more ambitious, take more of a role on the world stage, be more important, more powerful, that you attract the controversy that undermines that getting along?
No, I don't. I mean, Canada in any foreseeable future is not going to be 300 million people and is not going to, have a nuclear capacity and the rest of it. But that just makes us like 190 other nations. And the getting along is I mean, I don't know. I don't think that the nature of the world through the Cold War and even in periods before that, even in times of peace, was ever a world of getting along. I mean, it was a world at best of an absence of war. But I don't think it was ever a matter of finding commonality and in a lot of ways it didn't have to be, because again you could hide behind distance and border and the rest of it. But I think that what getting along really is like is with any group. I mean, it's being there, it's listening, it's patience, it's negotiation. It's trying to understand the other person. It's trying to get inside the skin of the other person. I mean, those are the things that are the central powers in a world of getting along. I mean, when it's a time of power and might and empire, I mean, it's all about weaponry and it's all about the size of your economy and so on. And I don't think the world is going to function very well in that way in the future. And so, a Canada, I mean, one of our strengths, and being at a couple of international conferences, and one where it was just countries from the Americas, and all of the other countries in the Americas outside of the US thought the Canadian experience with the U.S. was exactly, you know, was our experience was of something very different, in that we were, we had no problems, no conflicts, no misunderstandings in terms of the U.S. that we were then. And of course, you know, you listen to their experiences with the U.S. and they're the same as ours. You know, dealing with a power that is a whole lot bigger. When you're a whole lot bigger, you know, you don't listen a lot. You don't negotiate a lot. You start out maybe saying we're going to negotiate, and then if you don't get exactly what you're looking for, you pull out the power card and you play the power card and you have it, you know, your own way in it. And of realizing in those conferences that Canada actually had a terrifically important role in being an explainer, and of explaining the rest of the world to the U.S. because we talk a language and very similarly and seem so similar to Americans that they are less likely to see us as different than they are to see most other people as different. So to be an explainer of others to the U.S. and an explainer of the U.S. to others, and how incredibly important that was, and how incredibly that important that will be in the future. I mean, the U.S. is going to be an immensely important player in the world in any kind of foreseeable future, and it's really important that it be a very constructive, important player in the future. And we could play quite a significant role, I think, in that, as the intermediary, as the explainer, you know, in that way. So I don't think that the nature of our power is not something that is the same as the nature of historic power.
Yes?
I think you make a very strong point on how Canada's most colonialism and intolerance gives it a unique power in a globalized world where it's all about matters. But what I'm wondering is, how much can Canada contribute? How much are other countries likely to respect what Canada can do when Canada gained these characteristics to an extent in a test tube? So it got lucky geographically, it got lucky economically, it isn't troubled by the same strife that you see in so many other countries around the world.
That's a very good question. I mean, and that I remember in, this will seem to be, you know, sort of a little unrelated, but I remember we always use the Scandinavian countries as our models. You know, like, why can't we be more than like Sweden or Finland or in this? And in the end, thinking, no, it's not a question of model. It's a question of inspiration. And chances are the experience of Scandinavia is enough different from our own experience that if we try to replicate every step as you would with a model, it won't work. You use the inspiration to try to find other steps that may, you know, replicate or the same result in certain ways. And so it's a very good question. I mean, that we don't look like a lot of other 33 million people, countries in the world. You know, we are a lot larger geographically. We do live, you know, next to the U.S. and so on and so on. So how, in fact, would other countries see our experience as relevant to theirs when it would seem as if it's so different from theirs? But I think that the extent to which Canada has engaged in the world up until now, and we engage less now than we did. I mean, you know, economically we engage more, but politically and diplomatically we engage less. But, you know, up until 10 years or so ago, Canada was understood as a significant, you know, global player in a quiet kind of way. And I remember I was in Sudan a couple of years ago, and people sort of saying, "Where's Canada? Where's Canada? We miss Canada. Why isn't Canada? Where's the Canadian presence and this and that?" And I always thought that was, you know, our own story of ourselves, and that it was vastly overrated. But in fact, when I kept hearing it again and again, and I would ask people, and they would say, "No, in fact, you know, there are a couple of things that make
you like us and us realizing that you are like us. One is that you don't have a past as a colonizer. And you have no idea how important that is to us, that you don't bring with you a mentality of the colonizer. We are far more likely to accept you than to accept somebody that we know has that other history. That we haven't experienced you as somebody who has attempted to overpower us, overwhelm us economically or in some other fashion. We are used to dealing with you in conversation, in discussion. You aren't 300 million people. You are about the same size as we are. That we're all dealing with these few countries in the world that have had overwhelming power over us. So that while I think there are a lot of differences that might make it seem difficult to have that conversation and to be included in that sort of dynamic, I think there are a lot of other things that would suggest that that we would be allowed at that table and that we could be influential at that table.
Well, my question might be along the same lines of one of the ones that was asked before. But from the perspective of basically of a Canadian who's trying to actually figure out what it means to be a Canadian, what resonated with me in your talk was your kind of characterization of all these traits that many perceive as weaknesses but are in fact strengths, and all these things that to me tie together in a very tentative approach to the world. But then there was another part of your talk in which you actually want to strengthen that identity, and I wonder if that strengthening actually detracts from what actually makes that identity to begin, what actually constitutes that identity. And so how does that transition work, and how do we...
Again, a very good question. I mean, if we are to be sort of more of what I would suggest is in us to be, do we cease being we and cease to have the impact that we might have in that way? I don't think so, because, I mean, what we're talking about today is not any kind of transformation in power game kind of ways. It really is a matter of understanding what it is we are, and just expressing us and acting as what it is we are, and realizing that we can do that in more places and with a greater impact than we think. Now, does that in the end make us feel as if, we're only relatively small that way, but we really are the big indispensable actor in this, and we're going to start strutting around as if we are, and therefore disconnect ourselves from everybody else in the world, and therefore taking away all of our influence? I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that is the nature of our personality, and I think that's a pretty deep and profound personality of where, we know we're not the biggest, we know we're not this or not, we just think in the end that we're pretty good, and that we actually have that we matter, in some ways. I mean, I think that's all that we're talking about. I remember, and this is just sort of a personal story, but I think in some ways it also about about the country. I remember as a kid, the worst thing that I could hear from my parents, I think it was literally the worst thing that they could say, was if we had gone out and won a championship or something like that, and for them to say, "Oh, watch it, don't get a big head, don't get a big head." There was nothing worse than getting a big head.
I don't think that as a country that we are much at risk of getting a big hit. I don't think so. And I think that we just, you know, that we need more of, I think others see that. You know, they would say, you've got a real sense of perspective. You know, that you're this, but you're also that. It's always a yes, but you know, what was often said about us is that no matter what is said about us, no matter how good, we will say yes, but. And it'll be a tiny yes, and it'll be, you know, a gigantic capital letters but with exclamation marks going after it. And all that I'm really saying is no, it's both can be in small letters, but that yes is just as important as that but, and it may in fact be a little bit more important than the but in it. And that doesn't mean that yes is shrieked from the, no. It's just, you know, quietly, confidently understood as a, we're a yes, we're not a but. You know, we're a mixture of the two, but we're at least as much of a yes as we are a but.
Yes. We've been talking a lot about the theories and stuff. I want to ask like an actual practical question. And you mentioned the environment and how the U.S. in the last 8 years has not done a lot on the environment. However, I think that Canada, too, has not done a lot on the environment. And almost even maybe even worse than the States. Do you foresee Canada's policy on global warming changing in the near future with its current government or if the Liberals, your party, wins? Do you see it actually changing a lot, or do you think it'll be a lot of the status quo in the upcoming future?
I'm not, you know, as you may have noticed today that I have not once mentioned any party by name, any party leader by name. I'm not interested in doing that. I mean, as soon as that happens, this becomes a political conversation. And then as soon as that happens, you know, people's predispositions start to take over the game. And so what I would say to your question, And it was what I was trying to get at a little bit in the talk, is that that I think that what it is we will end up doing really, you know, in climate change, and you know, and each party will approach it somewhat differently, and one will do more, one will do less, and so on. But that what we will really do will have to do with our understanding of ourselves really as what it is we are. That a Canada of the way in which we think of ourselves now, you know, will do this much. And a Canada that is the Canada that we've been talking about today would do this much. And one party may be, you know, more here and more there, but really, you know, that's the essence of it is trying to deal with the ceilings. And to try to raise the ceiling for both parties, for all parties, you know, in all of that. And I think that climate change is a tough enough question that if you're not so inclined, that if you want not to do a lot about it, then you look around for the slowest horse in the race and you try to jump on it and ride it as long as you can. And so, you know, George Bush made a great slow horse in the race. And so he was an easy horse to ride. Mr. Obama is not such an easy horse to ride. And I think that, you know, that what, you know, will happen in Canada will be affected, you know, has been affected and will be affected, you know, to a great degree by what goes on in the U.S., but as well as what I'm saying in terms of that basic environment of how we understand ourselves. And yeah. Yes?
You mentioned earlier that we need a collective story and a unifying sort of idea or story to base ourselves off of. Would you say that, and you mentioned not to base this out of history, but would you say that our conflicted history, because Canada's history is not multicultural in its entirety, like, for instance, the French came and pretty much dominated the Aboriginals, and then the British came and dominated the French, and then later on during World War II, there was lots of anti-Asianism in government policy. and we did become more multicultural as China went on. But would you say that these historical events would be a hurdle to, or would threaten Canada's credibility as a multicultural negotiator in, on the world stage today? And if so, how could you overcome that hurdle?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that having that experience is sort of humbling. I mean, it is, you know, that look, this is, we know what we are, and part of what we are, this is our history. And in some way, we found our way to a different place, you know, in it. So, again, I mean, I think that the, I think the most important thing that way is that if our principal focus is back in time, and of trying to reorient traditional fights, and to find new words for old fights, and to try to, you know, re-engage those old fights to come out in a different place and the rest of it, I don't think we're going to succeed. I think that some, you know, that old fights become, as I was saying in my talk, become new fights. That people take, you know, it sort of instinctively take on the language of old fights. They take on the roles of old fights, and things just end up in the same place. I think the way to deal with old fights is to focus on what is, not on what was. It's like when you've got you know, two people, you know, in a debate, you know, or arguing with each other, they're going to end up, you know, sort of playing, you know, their understanding, their role, what, you know, and they will go back and forth, and you know that other person knows you, and it's just this. The only way you can break the bounds of that is to create something in the middle between them that seems to matter to each of them more than what the fight is back and forth. Something else to focus on. So long as they only focus on each other, they'll end up just focusing on each other, and it'll be history and old languages and old roles and the rest of it. So what is it that might actually come to feel more important to each of them, so they get so distracted away from those, you know, the traditional roles and the traditional fights, to actually, you know, move towards something else? And I think that emerges out of the present and into the future. I think that's where it's found. That if you try to put on the table, okay, this is history, right in the table, let's re-argue it and let's come out in a different place, I don't think so. You know, it's like, I mean, you know, with comedians, you know, there's the story and there's the punchline. Too many of our debates are all about punchlines, you know, and the punchline, you know, and once you get to the point of punchline, there's no space. I mean, you know, you've already got your polished words and phrases that you love, and you deliver your punchline, and the other side delivers their punchline, and you get nowhere. The only way you can get somewhere is to go back into the story. And even if they ended up with different punchlines, they didn't begin, you know, often with different stories. Or along the way, there was a lot of each, of the story of each that was the same. And you refined the common ground in the story, and you have a chance of getting to a different punchline. But if you're just dealing in punchlines, which is usually what happens when you're arguing about the past, you don't get anywhere.
I know that some students want to keep talking, but they're going to want to get a bite to eat before their 2:30.
Right.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure. Okay. If you don't mind, you asked a question before. We have two people here who have not. I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 50. Okay, whoever gets closest. It was 37, so.
I just wanted to ask, you've referenced Mr. Obama multiple times and his role in as a catalyst provoking conversations, a national conversation in America about what America is and where they're going. And I'm wondering, we briefly mentioned this, more specifically, if the Canadian political process, and particularly the party process in electing their leaders, is capable of producing a grassroots leader that can invoke that kind of national discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, that remains to be seen, but I think that what would have been said as recently as maybe even a year and a half ago is that that was not possible in the U.S. either. I mean, that all the time the early days of the election campaign, and not even such early days, I mean, even as things were advancing, and when it became a two-horse race with Hillary Clinton, there was still that assumption that he's going to stumble, we're going to find the inconsistencies, he doesn't really believe this, and so, in part, it's that it hasn't happened here. It's also in part because it hasn't happened basically anywhere else that I can think of, in the world, and that it wasn't going to happen in the U.S. either, but did. I think all that is good in that way is that if it happens one place, there's much more of a possibility of it happening somewhere else. And I think all politicians everywhere are under that pressure and under that gun now. I mean, and of where the public is sort of seeing a different way of doing things. And so if they are, then why not us? Why not you? So that's more promising than would have been the case even a year and a half ago. Thank you.
My very great pleasure to say thank you very much for coming to speak to us today. I have to say that I have been a fan for a very long time, since I was about as old as this young man. I grew up in Victoria, where you wouldn't hear words French spoken on the street from one year to the next, unless Bantam were playing, and that was everybody had to turn it to Radio Canada to get it. And my brother used to lead us in hockey games in the basement, and he was Frank Mihalovic, and my other brother was Yvon Cornouet, and they put me in goal. And I was Tim Dryden, the most person in the world. I admired you then, and of course I admire you very much now. I admire your political work as a mother with young children in daycare. I think it's wonderful to hear you come and speak in the university, especially because I think we're much better at teaching the world and analyzed from the point of view of politics than we are in dealing with inspiration and vision. So it's really a very great delight, treat, pleasure to hear you come and talk to the students about how the world cannot be reduced to politics, that there must be vision leading the politics. I think this is a super message to tell them. Wonderful to tell them that their conversations can become public conversations that can, in fact, lead politicians like yourself. That's something that I think our students need to hear. It's a great privilege for me to hear you speak. It's a great privilege for me to hear the students respond, meet your analysis with their analysis, meet your inspiration with their inspiration. This is one of the joys of teaching Canadian studies rather than history, my other hat. And I just wanted to say thank you to you. Thank you to everybody here. And in order to say thank you to you, we will have a student come up and present you with a small token. This is a student from our Canadian studies class, Marie-Lise Jacobson.
Thank you very much. It's really nice of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.